You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is your partner, Big Boy. Interested in giving back to your community while making new connections in your neighborhood? Introducing Neighbor to Neighbor, a California volunteers network that empowers you to take action, contribute to local needs, and be a part of something bigger than yourself. Visit ca-neighbors.com to learn more about how you can get to know your neighbor and strengthen your community. Neighbor to Neighbor, it takes a neighborhood. Hello.
I tried to Google fun facts about Pittsburgh. Want to guess what I found?
Nothing.
Exactly right. Fun fact, and this is true, there's nothing fun about Pittsburgh. That's why when you Google it, you get notable facts like George Washington passed through the city limits on two occasions on his way somewhere worthwhile. Or they have the world's largest museum dedicated to one of the world's most boring artists. Want to guess who?
Let me think. I think I know the answer from something I heard before. Andy Warhol.
Andy Warhol is right. A giant museum because the man just collected garbage, produced videos so boring even his friends walked out. Now, we're not going to be focusing on Warhol so much for this episode. We're going to be focusing on another Pittsburgh native, Burton Morris.
I feel like who Art Ed?
I'm trying to spice it.
Who Art Ed? Mr. Wood, Art Ed, me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's
off
to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, where we explore visual arts in an audio medium. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and today my guest is Chuck Hoff, the art teacher from Mill Street Elementary. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Kyle. Look forward to having this discussion today.
Yeah, today we're going to be talking about Burton Morris. He is an American pop art painter. He's a contemporary artist, actually, still living and working today. And he hails from Pittsburgh, which is why we opened with a little bit of information about Pittsburgh. And are you familiar with his work?
A little bit. I was able to do a hard crunch on the internet and then found that most of the stuff I saw on the many episodes of Friends.
Yeah, he was one of those artists that like I had seen a million times before I had any idea who he was. He was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1964, and he earned his BFA from Carnegie Mellon University in 1986. So like when I think about when he was coming out of school, you know, mid to late 80s, that's the time of like Warhol and Keith Haring, which I have to say probably informed his work quite a bit. Now, like Warhol, he also started his career in advertising. I feel like I could spend this entire episode saying, like Warhol. I mean, he is a little bit different. He does his own thing. I'd say in a lot of ways, sort of more polished and presentable than a lot of Warhol's stuff. But a lot of stuff very, very much has that Warhol feel to me. He actually opened his own studios, Burton Morris Studios, in 1990. So he started off in advertising and then moved into, you know, his own studio practice. And he started making essentially like small icons into large scale paintings. I think he referred to them as like instant happenings. Is that right?
That's what I read, yes.
Yeah. The biggest bit of recognition, like I said, I saw him a million times before I even knew who he was. He had those corporate connections because he started his career in advertising. And no doubt that helped him to land plum gigs where his work would be featured in the background on a little-known television program called Friends. Are you familiar with it?
A little bit. And it was funny to do some of my research and find that it wasn't as subtle as I thought. Like, as I was looking at some of the still shots, it was everywhere. It was on the back walls. It was on T-shirts. He basically made the icon his, and he kind of branded the show which yeah, is and, pretty and clever. Which it is pretty clever. Yeah.
So. Yeah, it is weird. It feel and also like his artwork feels very 90s to me. You know what I mean? Like, not just because of the fact that it was produced in the 90s, but also because it has the feel of clip art. You know what I mean? It's like Microsoft Clippy started making paintings.
That's exactly what I thought. I was particularly struck with his like coffee mug and some of the diner or restaurant themed ones and like his Coca-Cola. And I thought, where have I seen this before? And I remember it was a giant box you received when you first bought a computer. And it had, you had the option of like, you know, grabbing 100,000 clip art images for free. And yeah, so, and it, yeah.
Well, and it's funny too, because like as a child of the 90s, like I remember, you know, those desktop publishing things where everybody was making really terrible homemade cards and stuff like that. And like, his paintings have that feel of like the clip art you were embarrassed to have on your card. And he just like ran with it.
You know what I mean? He did. And I also think like, you know, good for him that he came up with something that probably thought, you know, he could synthesize, he could make it so much more simple and use so much less data. Like later, you know, as he's continuing his artwork and evolving a little bit, it's just so easy to mass produce and I don't know, to call it his, but how do you differentiate that from someone else drawing similar?
Well, and that's the central sort of conundrum of the pop art movement. So it is worth saying he is sort of a pop art painter. And a lot of that is sort of deceptively simple because the images do feel very flat. They feel very familiar. And that's not by accident. We both know the pop art movement was focused on pop culture and consumerism and all of the things that the symbols and icons that we see everywhere that we are inundated with. You know, in a lot of ways, what he does is he takes those small things that we see all the time that go unnoticed and unappreciated, and he makes them large scale and in your face, and he presents them in a gallery so you have to stop and take notice. You know what I mean?
Well, and yeah, I was going to say, I was on a separate or slightly a bit of a tangent. We're inundated right now with e-learning, and one of the really clicky and trendy things to do is to turn everything into Bitmojis.
I feel attacked right now.
Yeah, and attacked is a better word.
Because I just spent so much time on my delightfully tacky Bitmoji classroom.
Correct. And so, yeah, and I'm thinking, there he is. He came, like if he had to, you know, be the fortune teller as to where he was heading, this is it. Just simplifying every single image to a cartoon, if you will.
Well, actually, if I recall, where he's heading is back to the Friends coffee shop or whatever. I think he's doing like a pop-up gallery or installation doing a tribute to his Friends artwork.
And it's funny.
He peaked in the 90s.
Yeah, right, and it's kind of funny. Yeah, and I was thinking his net worth would be, you know, 10, 20, 30 million because of momentum and what he's done since then. But no, I mean, we're 1.6 million, which is kind of the life.
I'd take it,
but it is the lifespan of like, you know, a professional, if you will. So he's had to work hard. Like this hasn't stopped.
Yeah, I mean, because he's a well-known, you know, he's well known in the art world. He's pretty commercially successful. And a lot of people think of like, because you see those astronomical price tags of, you know, Banksy's and other artists who become household names, people just assume, you know, he's got to have so much money, which I mean, not to say he doesn't. I mean, one point, whatever you said, good amount of money, but that's over a 30-year career. It's not like every single painting he does auctions for seven figures, the way you think of like a Picasso or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, and so now he is actually doing work that is sort of paying tribute to his earlier work that brought him so much fame. And in some ways, like, it seems so appropriate that a pop artist would be featured on an NBC sitcom, and, you know, about, like, people who just seem to be sitting around in a coffee shop all day in New York. Money doesn't seem to be an issue, and they're just inventing wacky problems to get themselves in and out of. Like, there's so much about it that just seems so, like, perfectly superficial. You know what I mean? In the synthesis of it. And like, Friends, it feels like they're just almost, like, self-consciously taking on, like, let's populate it with, like, pop art graphics.
Yes. You know? And it kind of, it may be just what we need to take our minds off of the social issues we're dealing with maybe today, where you're thinking this spinoff might actually work, and this actually might work today. Because of today's issues.
Are you binging reruns of Friends? Is that what you're telling me?
I think a steady diet of
Friends. Is that your safe space?
Yeah, Friends and maybe Seinfeld.
Yeah. I definitely prefer the second of those two.
Yes.
Now, looking at his artwork, getting back to the actual topic at hand. So one of the things we talked about is the simplicity of the design, although it is sort of deceptively simple, because as much as, like, it, you or I could draw a coffee cup fairly easily.
Yeah.
It's very carefully and meticulously rendered, you know, and he creates these icons that, in a lot of ways, they look like woodcuts, but they're paintings. And the reason I say they look like they're woodcuts is because of the sort of hatching lines that we see. For audience, I guess the hatching lines, they're these black lines that are used to indicate shadow. And the more of them there are and the closer they are together, the darker it's going to appear, right?
Yeah.
It calls back to, like, printmaking methods. And aside from the obvious, like, Warhol influence and Keith Haring influence, from what I understand, Burton Morris was a big fan of Albrecht Dürer. So you're familiar with Dürer, you know, a couple hundred years ago, he was making wood carvings.
Right.
To create his prints. And so that's where we see that style coming out with all of those lines, like I said, sort of the hatching lines. And he's making almost a cartoon version of those hatching lines, right? Where they become these wedges and this, like, cartoon burst, but also have that sort of shading effect.
And I see that, but Kyle, I struggle a little bit because I also see Brito.
Ramiro Brito, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of his. And I've looked at his work, and I find it to be almost a dead comparison. Like, when I see the two, I just see so much going on that resembles each other. Both artists are branding their stuff, and both artists are healthy and in different shops and trying to, you know, put their stuffs on shoes and different, you know, I don't know. Just it was interesting to me. That was the first thing that came to mind. Not sure what you thought.
Well, the comparison to Ramiro Brito, of course, makes sense to me. I mean, they're both poppy artists. I find Ramiro Brito more interesting in most of his work because of the fact that it's not straight pop. It has a little bit of cubist influence, and yeah, the way he incorporates different patterns, there's more of a transformational quality to Ramiro Brito, whereas Burton Morris is more direct in copying what he's doing and simplifying it and translating it to this print style, much like Lichtenstein to me. You yeah. know, Lichtenstein had so much with the dots, calling back another printmaking method, but to me that's where I went, because it is very direct copying of what he is seeing. He does invent a little bit of his own imagery and things like that, but you know, the Statue of Liberty, he's not like fragmenting her. He's not putting wild patterns on there. It's green with black marks for the shadows and stuff like that.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Sleep Cove podcast can help you. Hi, I'm Christopher Fitton, the voice and clinical hypnotherapist behind Sleep Cove. Sleep Cove features sleep hypnosis, meditations, and bedtime stories, all designed to help those of you who struggle at night to achieve a restful and peaceful night's sleep. Search for Sleep Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see why Sleep Cove helps millions of people sleep deeply all night long.
The one piece I want to dive a little bit deeper into for this, I guess, would be his nightstand portrait, specifically the Warhol, just because I think it's interesting to me, because we started off with comparisons to Warhol. They're both from Pittsburgh. They're both in the pop art movement. And his nightstand portraits, even though they're not necessarily what made him famous, I feel like it's where he became interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So do you want to describe what you're seeing in the Warhol portrait?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, in as we break down the composition of this piece, I can appreciate the triangle that he put in place with the soup can, the eyeglasses, and the Polaroid. So to me, it triangulates and keeps you kind of focused in those three objects. And, you know, a little bit on the flowers behind it. But what we're looking at is a Polaroid of Marilyn Monroe. And we're looking at a soup can. And then we're looking at some eyeglasses. And I think
it's interesting that you right off the bat start talking about the movement across the composition with those three things. I totally see it, especially because of the angles. I'm noticing now that you've said that the Polaroid's coming out at an angle that leads very nicely into like the frame of the glasses, and then the glasses create these lines that lead you right back to that soup can. And those three things do seem to have the most weight in the composition. That's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that.
And for me, it's just like, you know, because you want to differentiate, like, you know, the idea that a person would be like a copy artist, or that he's just so enamored by a movement that he stays there forever. You still want some structure. Like, you still want to know and be reminded that we all went to some of the same primary art classes and had some ideas of composition. So that's the first thing that struck me. Of course, the second thing, color, you know, Polaroid camera is very pop arty, contrasting colors. Soup can is made to look like the soup can. So you have that happening right next to each other. And I find that to be pretty interesting. But his use of colors, simple as it may, his combination of the opposite colors, staying cool in one section and warm in the other, it really works.
Yeah, I mean, there is good contrast to make every color pop and seem bright. I think also, like you say, the fact that it's a Polaroid, you know, and the soup can, those are things that are so much identified with Andy Warhol. Because of the fact that, like, the Polaroid, it's so disposable. You know what I mean? Like, it you don't walk into someone's home and see like Polaroids that are neatly matted and framed. Like a Polaroid is just like that instant gratification, which on some level I feel like pop art was so much about, and in some ways sort of questioning and focusing on like what we're doing with that stuff. And I think the other thing that's interesting that we haven't even talked about is this is a portrait of Andy Warhol, but where is Andy? He's not here. Like you were talking so much about the elements and how it's arranged, but the thing that to me was screaming that I find so interesting about this is it's a portrait of a person without including any visual of that person. It is symbols of them. Like we see the Studio 54 logo on a card, which, you know, Andy Warhol would frequent Studio 54, which right there, that tells us a little bit about, you know, Warhol as this somewhat decadent and celebrity obsessed and, you know, cultural figure and icon. We see the Polaroid camera that also happens to be shooting out the Marilyn Monroe, which is one of Warhol's most famous series. We see the tomato soup can, which again is one of his most famous works of art. Like, we're not seeing necessarily like his lesser known stuff. The reason the Warhol Museum is like the biggest dedicated to a single artist is because Andy Warhol had a factory turning out stuff. Like, I think of Andy Warhol, and I know this is not going to be a popular opinion. He is proof. Even a blind squirrel will find a nut if it forages long enough. Not to make light of physically challenged small woodland creatures, it's just Andy Warhol basically was churning out garbage from his factory, but occasionally he did stumble onto something that was really great and innovative and brilliant. But like, if you turn out enough stuff, there will be a couple of hits and people will forget about the myriad misses, you know? Like, he was just filming people doing mundane tasks that just like would bore everyone to death, but people forget about that and they remember, oh yeah, the colorful Marilyn, the flowers, yeah, the soup can.
And I kind of see, yeah, this being like his greatest hits. So I kind of look and I see that the self-portrait would be the eyeglasses, but I also see that he doesn't try too hard to overstate this. Like, he doesn't go way out there and try to be something other than himself. So like, I see that he consistently will at times put shadows in different positions. So the shadow of the glasses are to the left and the shadow of the Polaroids to the right. So there isn't like the light in this source is going to only fit as there is space. So he's going to throw a shadow this way because there's just appropriate space.
Yeah, so it's like it's more just what does the picture need than what's actually happening in front of him.
Right. And so, yeah, so he looks at the objects. He says, yes, these are the 3, 4, 5 objects that I could sneak in there, and people will identify only Andy Warhol. But I'm not going to overextend. I'm going to be very careful that you don't see through the eyeglasses.
And I feel like that is the theme of his work. I'm not going to overextend.
Yes.
Let's keep it simple. Let's keep it surface level.
Yes. And I could appreciate it because I know as I'm sketching personally, there's times when I get into that trap where I'm like, oh no. And this now sketch is going to be a 4 or 5 hour sketch because I went too far with it. Like, I've decided to add value or do a crosshatch that's a lot more complex. These are all timed photographs, I feel like, or paintings or prints or whatever. But I feel like each of them are 2 to 3 hours. Like, there's something about what he does. You know what I mean? If it's computer generated, maybe it's an hour.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure these are acrylics.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure he's doing it by hand. I could be wrong in that, but I thought he was doing acrylics. Maybe that changes over time, but you know, for me it's not even about the medium. It's not even about the time. It's to me it feels like it's all right there on the surface. And I go back and forth on that because on the one hand, sometimes I look at it and I get frustrated because I'm just like, well, the soup can symbolizes obviousness. You know, I mean, like, it's just like all right in front of you. It's just like, I'm making a portrait of Andy Warhol. Let's take the most recognizable symbols of him, his most famous works, throw it together. On the other hand, there's something interesting about, you know, I do have to say legitimately, I respect the idea of coming up with portraits through objects, through a still life as representing the person and representing the figure. I just feel like there is no greater insight, you know? At the same time, like, art can just be fun. And this is fun to look at, you know?
Right. Like, unless you have a, you know, hyperrealism is definitely one section. And what Chuck Close was doing was another section of, like, self-portraits. But I really appreciate the theme, you know, nightstand portraits. Because that, to me, that type of branding...
Yeah. Yeah, and there's something about, like, the nightstand that I think is an interesting symbol also in there. Because, like, when we think about the bedroom, it's like when you're a kid, your bedroom is the first and really only place that you can decorate and make yours. And it's a reflection of your personality. Like, and then, you know, as you get older, your bedroom is your private space. It's, you know, you're sleeping, you're vulnerable there. And so there's something about a nightstand that feels a little bit sort of intimate and unguarded. And I think it's an interesting concept that I wish were developed further.
It, particularly because it infuses his art, pop art, and then these characters. I mean, he could do this for every single artist, and it would be, it's brilliant. It's a really nice way to attack.
Well, and it is a pretty big series. Like, he does this with fictional characters. We see, like, you know, the Batman nightstand portrait and stuff. He does it with, you know, the sports ball players and stuff like that.
He does like Mickey, Toy Story, Popeye. Yeah.
He's done tons of stuff. And so, I think there is sort of fertile ground there for him to explore. Like I said, I get conflicted over it. I'm wrapping it up.
I want
just a 3-point rating scale.
And
where should this hang? The Louvre? Is this something to look at? The lab? Is this something to learn from? Or the Louvre?
British for the bathroom.
Yeah,
there's
the
Louvre joke in there somewhere.
Oh, that's terrible. I'm going to go with the Louvre. But I'm going to go with the Louvre because I enjoy my time. in the loo, so I would again.
It's a pleasant distraction.
It is, and I don't think his paintings necessarily are at a level of that. But I just think, like I was telling you before, it's an Airbnb themed bedroom.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much range he presented me.
That's fair enough.
Okay.
I was conflicted. Like I say, I keep going back and forth on it. But I think where I ultimately end up is I would put this in the Louvre. Because the Louvre, you know, museums, that's where I feel like I want to see stuff that's enjoyable to look at. You know? Everyone should see and enjoy the work. The lab, I feel like you learn from that piece, even if you don't like it. And I feel like the Louvre needs, and other museums need pieces that are just enjoyable. That you don't need to study, you don't need to know, like, you know, like when I look at like Mondrian or something, it's
sure.
Like, why do I care about the primary colors of squares and rectangles? And, you know, with this, it's like I don't need to know the bigger ideas behind it. I can look at that and be like, that's bright and colorful and fun. And even if I don't know who Andy Warhol is, I have an entry point where I can see like a Polaroid camera and a tomato soup can and artifacts that I can recognize and make sense of. And then I can see these colors that seem bright and fun and enjoyable to look at. And I can enjoy the aesthetics even, you
well,
know?
And this is where I become a both Cubs and Sox fan, because
yeah.
I would say his nightstand portraits are Louvre, like you've said, because I see a huge jumping, like I think
yeah.
I think he's had a big quantum leap.
Yeah. I mean, of everything I've seen him do,
yeah,
those nightstand portraits, that's where it becomes interesting to me.
Okay.
Everything else, you know, again, it's not that it's bad. Like, it's all very, very well done. I certainly would not fault him for that. It's just not interesting to me. And, you know, like, a lot of it looks okay. Some of it, to me, feels like it's not even, like, that aesthetically pleasing. The nightstand portraits, because it's more than one thing, you know, it's this collection.
Yeah.
And that gets me to linger on it a little bit longer, even if I'm not trying to puzzle over it to make sense of it. You know what I mean?
So I think we agree on that. Like,
yeah.
Pre-nightstand portraits or anything other than that, I struggle with a little bit because there's just not enough there. But these nightstand portraits, I'm like, that's pretty genius. And I can say that that's like a spin on still lives. You know, it's like a really cool, contemporary, and trendy still life.
Yeah.
Which, cool.
Like I said, that's what I thought. It was interesting.
All right.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to discuss a collection of junk might be seen on Andy Warhol's nightstand. I appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate the time. And he, like, I'm so glad I selected him. Knew him a little, know him a lot more, and look forward to seeing it a little bit more on Friends.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted. If you found this tolerable, please like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week in the show notes on Twitter at WoodArtEd and on the website WhoArtedPodcast.com. Podcast done.